From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2018. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Immigration remained a very contentious issue in the United States throughout 2018. In September 2017, President Trump rescinded the Obama-era executive order that established the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. This program gave temporary protection to a group of young undocumented migrants who arrived in the United States as children. Then U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said the DACA program would end in March 2018 unless Congress passed an alternative program. Ending DACA with no congressional intervention meant that 1.2 to 1.8 million of these young people, the so-called Dreamers, would be subjected to deportation. Congressional Republicans and Democrats each had their own versions of addressing the fate of the Dreamers. But neither side could agree with the other on appropriate legislation. Republican Congressman Will Hurd of Texas co-sponsored the bipartisan USA Act with California Democrat Pete Aguilar. The bill would have provided legal status to the Dreamers and also bolster U.S.-Mexico border security. We begin our look back at 2018 with our February visit with Congressman Hurd at his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Hurd, a native of San Antonio, Texas, recently won a third term in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. He gave us his perspective of this proposed USA Act.
Congress has proven over the years, this is my second term, so I'm starting my fourth year in Congress, but Congress over the years has proven its inability to do comprehensive and partisan. So let's try something different. Let's try something narrow and bipartisan. And it starts with, you got to accept the fact that immigration is good. The United States has benefited from the brain drain and the hardworking drain of every other country for the last couple of decades and century, some would say. So let's continue that. And let's also fix a very narrow problem of these 1.2 to 1.8 million kids that have come to the United States through no fault of their own. You know, 97% of this population are folks that are in school and are working. 5% are entrepreneurs, which is more than twice the national average. And so this, to me, is a very simple way to solve this problem. So what we did is, for 1.2 million kids, we're going to give a permanent legislative fix. You're going to be in a temporary status, which is DACA, Deferred Action, I always forget.
For childhood arrivals.
For childhood arrivals. So that's a temporary status. And if you do certain things, like you've worked for 80% of your time that you've been in the United States, you've completed an entire tour in the military. So if you go in the Army and it's 3 years, then great. If you're in the Navy and it's 2 years, then fine. Or you have finished 2 years of post-secondary education, you go from temporary status to legal permanent resident, LPR status. And you're afforded all the things that someone in LPR status are afforded. So that's the fix for DACA. Then you have strong border security. It's 2018. We do not have operational control of our borders. And the reason we don't have operational control is we haven't been looking at all 2,000 miles of the border at the same time. And the only way you can look at all 2,000 miles of border at the same time is utilizing a lot more technology along our border. So it says, hey, Department of Homeland Security, you're going to get operational control of our border by 2020, and you're going to do that by having a mile-by-mile assessment of all the tools that you need, whether it's physical barrier, technology, manpower, in order to achieve operational control. We also allow more immigration judges. One of the problems that we have with some of the immigration cases is you don't have enough judges to hear cases, so people get released on their own recognizance, so you know the backlog is great. And we also call for a coordinator in the White House to work with our Central American allies in the Northern Triangle to work on some of the root cause issues that has spurred and allowed some of the unaccompanied minor issues that we've dealt with here in the United States. So it's a lot easier to address the root cause, and most of these families don't want to send their kids on perilous trips, so let's help address the problem locally.
Every March is Women's History Month in the United States, and we marked the occasion this past year by examining the record number of female veterans running for elective office. Our guest for this program was Elaine Luria, a former surface warfare officer and nuclear engineer for the U.S. Navy. Ms. Luria ran for Congress as a Democrat in November's midterm elections. Elaine Luria sought to capture the seat for the state of Virginia's 2nd District, which has been held by a Republican. She told us about the main factors that motivated her to run for elective office.
Well, I think that, like many veterans, trying to continue to serve my community and my country. So when I look back on my career, you mentioned a few of the things that I did over those 20 years, but I was very fortunate to attend the Naval Academy. And the first day as a plebe at the Naval Academy, you learn the mission, which includes to develop leaders for the highest positions of command, citizenship, and government. So the entire time that I served in the Navy in different capacities, I always had in my mind that there was sort of an obligation or an expectation to continue to serve. And as I transitioned out of the Navy and also became a small business owner in my community and got very involved at a local level, I thought that there was no better way in our current political climate where I didn't want to sit on the sidelines. And I thought that this was the time for me to serve. And with my background in the military, national security, and also being a small business owner, I thought that gave me a great foundation to represent the district where I live.
Media outlets reported that some veterans expressed concern about the current Trump administration and his role as U.S. Commander-in-Chief. I asked Elaine Luria about the impact of President Trump's policies on her decision to run for Congress.
Well, I think in answering that question, I like to go back down to my district. And the current representative in our district says that his job as a leader is to find clarity in chaos. And so I look back over my 20 years, my leading thousands of sailors during my career, and I think that he couldn't be more wrong. My job was never to find clarity in chaos. It was to prevent the chaos in the first place. So when I look at that, I think that that chaos has permeated through many policies and many bills that have been voted on by our current representative. And the people across the district are just not happy with those decisions and how they're being represented. So really, that's what propelled me to throw my hat in and to run and try to serve our district better than he currently is.
Elaine Luria ultimately did defeat her Republican opponent in the midterm election. And in January 2019, will begin to serve her constituents in Virginia's 2nd District as their new congresswoman. Press Conference USA visited Capitol Hill again in April to talk with Democratic Congressman Brad Schneider. Congressman Schneider represents Illinois' 10th Congressional District. During his April state visit to Washington, D.C., French President Emmanuel Macron addressed a joint session of Congress. Congressman Schneider was there and shared his impressions of the French president's speech.
Well, I thought it was a great speech. I thought he put into a frame very eloquently the relationship between our two nations, the United States and France, have a close relationship going back to the very beginnings of our nation. And I think he talked about the challenges we face as a world. I was pleased to see him call for the United States to re-engage in the Paris Climate Accord. I actually introduced a resolution condemning the decision to pull out. I think the United States has to be a part of that. I was pleased to hear him call for multilateralism, was the term he used many times. I believe the United States has a very important role in global affairs, that the world is a safer, better place when the United States is leading, is working with our allies, France, the Europeans, Africa, around the world. The world needs the United States, but the United States needs to engage in the world as well. And I appreciated that call.
During his visit, President Macron tried to persuade U.S. President Donald Trump not to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is also known as the Iran Nuclear Agreement. Congressman Schneider agreed with President Macron that the United States should remain a party to the multi-nation agreement.
Well, and President Macron said this, if you think about Iran, the most important thing that hopefully everyone in Congress and across the country and our allies agree on is that Iran must never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. Not now, not during the term of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, but not ever. And President Macron said that. I have said that for a long time. I have real concerns about the agreement and have voiced those in the past, but again, what President Macron said, I thought very well yesterday, is until we have something better, walking away carries grave risk. Walking away will either leave the United States isolated if we walk away unilaterally and the Europeans stay, or on the other hand, if the Iranians say the United States left, we're going to rush to a nuclear weapon. We need to close the gaps and reduce the risks of the agreement. We need to make sure that Iran is never allowed to have a nuclear weapon. But I believe, and President Macron emphasized this, that working with our allies to reduce the risk, close the gaps, to ensure that Iran is adhering to the nuclear agreement for the term of the agreement, and that the world with U.S. leadership is working to make sure that as elements of this agreement expire, we're in a position to make sure Iran is no better positioned or closer to a nuclear weapon than they are today. That's what we have to do.
Nonetheless, almost 2 weeks after Emmanuel Macron's visit, President Trump announced that the U.S. would withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement. In May, I spoke with William Galston, chair in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and that's a policy group based here in Washington, about his new book, Anti-Pluralism, the Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy. In his book, Galston, an expert on U.S. domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections, argues that the Great Recession, institutional dysfunction, and a growing divide between urban and rural prospects has created a populist backlash in politics. Galston specifically focused on why failed efforts to effectively address immigration also played a significant role in the rise of populism around the world.
When I started thinking about populism 5 years ago, I didn't think that. When I gave pride of place to economic factors. But I tried to remain open to the evidence as I was developing my thinking, and more evidence came in that immigration was playing a larger role in the populist upsurge in more countries than I had previously understood. It turned out to be a major cause of the Brexit vote. It turned out to be the leading cause of the shift of 9% of people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 into Donald Trump's column in 2016. And it turned out to be a huge issue in Europe, which just got bigger when Angela Merkel decided in the spring of 2015 to admit more than 1 million asylum seekers. That supercharged the rise of the AfD in Germany. It supercharged the rise of the League in Italy. It had a range of other ripple effects. And perhaps most important, it saved Viktor Orban's neck. He was in deep trouble in 2014, but he put himself at the head of the anti-immigration parade in 2015 and reinvigorated his political career and became the leader of European populism as a result. So I changed my mind about that because the evidence as I saw it forced me to. Does that mean that the economy isn't important? No, it's very important. But there, too, I've deepened my thinking. I've come to believe that the heart of the problem is the growing gap between diverse, highly educated, and growing metropolitan areas on the one hand, and stagnant or shrinking smaller towns and rural areas on the other. You see this pattern replicated in the United States, the UK, and throughout most of Europe as well.
You're listening to the best of Press Conference USA 2018 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, reminding you that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Now let's get back to today's Press Conference USA, featuring highlights of the program over the past year. In June, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was considered the swing vote in the highest court in the land, announced that he would retire at the end of July. Justice Kennedy's departure provided President Trump with a second opportunity to select a Supreme Court justice. Trump's choice for Justice Kennedy's replacement was Brett Kavanaugh, a sitting judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Before taking a seat on the Supreme Court bench, all nominees must be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. To determine a nominee's worthiness for a position on the Supreme Court, the candidate must face a series of confirmation hearings before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and then receive a majority of positive votes by members of the Senate. Judge Kavanaugh's hearings were quite explosive since a number of women made allegations of past sexual misconduct. In September, we hosted Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute and a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, to discuss Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation and why this choice pleased most Republicans, but infuriated most Democrats.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, obviously, Justice Kennedy, very well-regarded Supreme Court justice, well-loved by all watchers of the court, and a very thoughtful, careful justice. So his decision to retire at this time, having seen the confirmation of one of his former law clerks, Neil Gorsuch, to the Supreme Court, first time ever, actually, that a former law clerk and a sitting justice have sat together on the Supreme Court, and then having his other former law clerk, Brett Kavanaugh, nominated, I think is a unique moment for Justice Kennedy, a unique moment for the nation. A lot of people have raised concerns, as you say, about the replacement of Justice Kennedy, who is perceived by some as a swing vote, with what they perceive as a more conservative justice in Brett Kavanaugh, as a shift in the court's jurisprudence. But one thing to remember is that, you know, as the court looks at cases going forward, it's very much focused on each case individually. And justices often end up in very different places than you might think based on the person that nominated them, the president that nominated them, or their own personal political views. And in a lot of ways, that's as it should be, because judges should be applying not their own personal political views, but the way the law is as passed by our Congress and signed by the president. So that's an important facet, I think, of both Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh's jurisprudence, which is a caution in setting policy from the bench, rather looking more at the words passed by the Congress and signed by the president into law.
Jamil Jaffer shared his personal thoughts on the nomination and appointment of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
Well, look, Judge Kavanaugh, like a lot of the recent nominees before him, going back to Elena Kagan and other recent nominees, Judge Gorsuch, obviously highly qualified, obviously very smart. Went to Yale twice, been on the bench 12 years, 300 cases, a long record. The Senate canon should judge him based on that record and the materials they've gotten and his hours and hours of testimony. And I think that at some point in this country, we've got to get to the point where we say, look, we recognize Republicans are going to put conservatives on the court, Democrats are going to put liberals on the court. That's the nature of this business, has been for 200 some plus years. That's the situation we live in. The question is this person qualified? Are they dramatically outside the mainstream? If the answer is no, they should be confirmed by significant majorities. We've gotten away from that. We used to do that just 10, 15, 20 years ago, not that long ago. We're not that far removed. And yes, we're in a very polarized place in this country today, but that could be a first step of the Senate becoming more adult and the Congress being more adult and bringing our body politic to a more adult place instead of the partisan bickering that we see today that's been magnified by recent debates in the recent elections.
Violent volcanic eruptions in the Central American country of Guatemala and the U.S. state of Hawaii grabbed news headlines this past May and June. On May 3rd, residents of Hawaii's Big Island were put on high alert following an eruption of the Kilauea volcano. The volcano gushed with lava near the island's eastern edge, threatening lives and wreaking devastation. A month later, on June 3rd, Guatemala's Fuego volcano erupted, killing at least 190 people, injuring 57, and leaving thousands more homeless. So the topic for June's Science Edition of Press Conference USA was about volcanoes. Host Rick Pantaleo spoke with Charles Mandeville, the program coordinator of the Volcano Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. He told us where the most active volcanoes on Earth are located.
Typically, the most active volcanoes on Earth, Rick, are going to be around the Pacific Ring of Fire. There's about 1,550 volcanoes above sea level worldwide, and 955 of those are along the Pacific Rim, either in the Andes and Central America, the northwestern portion of the United States, over to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, and then over to the Kamchatkan Peninsula in Russia, and then the Kuril Islands, and then the Japanese island chain, and then on into the Philippines, and then on into the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, and then Tonga Kermadec down near New Zealand. We've got, at least just in the Pacific Rim, we've got over half of the world's active volcanoes. The others are going to be in the regions of Italy and Greece, obviously, and also the Afar region of Africa and the East African Rift, and then in the Indian Ocean, and then in Indonesia, which has over on the order of about 120 volcanoes.
Charles Mandeville provided some assurance that technological advancements may provide more accurate and timely volcano eruption warnings.
Unfortunately, we've gotten much better at predicting eruptions for the simple reason we've gotten much better at instrumenting volcanoes, not just with seismometers, but other instruments like continuous GPS receivers, tilt meters that can tell a change in slope on the volcano with an amount that's maybe 1/1,000th of a degree. Mm-hmm. And we also have a whole new generation of satellites up in the sky that can tell us when the ground at a particular volcano is swelling. And it's literally inflating because the magma chamber system beneath the volcano is being pressurized with gas and a supply of new magma. What's really transformed volcano monitoring in the past 20 years, and certainly within the past 10, is the fact that we can have multiple real-time data streams coming in on a volcano from ground-based instruments as well as satellite-based instruments, such that we can see eruption precursors.
Immigration was again a topic of discussion in September when I spoke with Doris Meissner, the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She is now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. Some analysts have said that underlying Mr. Trump's approach to immigration, both illegal and legal, is a disdain for all immigrants, which they say flies in the face of our foundational principle that the United States is fundamentally a nation of immigrants. Doris Meissner shared her thoughts on President Trump's approach to immigration.
Well, the Trump administration certainly does represent a very different approach and basic set of views about immigration. It's interesting, even though we've had strong policy disagreements between the Republican and the Democratic parties over the years on how immigration should actually be handled, what specific policies should be, for instance, at the border or towards asylum seekers. Nonetheless, there's been a broad consensus shared by Republicans and Democrats that overall, immigration is a net positive for our country. It's part of our history. It belongs part of our future. That is not the view that President Trump has carried or has brought into office. His view and his characterization of immigration is that immigration represents a threat to the country, that it represents a threat to national security and a threat to American workers and jobs. And so he has staked a presidential election and a candidacy on that, along with several other topics, such as trade, that have to do with globalism and international issues. But immigration was a real driving element of his campaign for the presidency. That has not happened before. That has not happened in the modern era of American politics. And most people did not believe that that could be a winning strategy. But in fact, as we know, of course, it was. And the other thing that goes with that is that this is a president who has been deeply committed to keeping his promises. And on immigration, that is coming to pass. The promises made in the campaign have been the governing playbook for the administration on immigration issues. As a result, we've seen the things that you've talked about, the travel ban, reductions in refugee resettlement, all things that he talked about during the campaign. So what we're seeing is those promises kept, but those are promises that are at strong contradiction or disagreement from what our history has been on immigration.
On November 6th, U.S. voters headed to the polls and elected a new Congress. Political analysts predicted that the outcome of the election was sure to have a profound impact on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. And sure enough, the Democrats captured at least 40 more seats in the House of Representatives, wresting control of that chamber of Congress from the Republicans, beginning in January 2019. In October, a few weeks before the election, we featured a two-part series that examined the prospects for both Democratic and Republican congressional candidates. The first installment featured Democratic strategist Will Marshall, the president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute, a centrist Washington-based policy group. Will Marshall provided his insights on the Democrats' chances of retaking at least one chamber of Congress in such a highly polarized atmosphere which prevails in U.S. politics today.
Well, it's a tough place to be in this tribalized period in American politics. There's no question about it. Everybody's in their team and cheering on their team. And it seems that compromise is kind of a sin with true believers on both sides of the aisle. But the American political system, our democracy, is built around power sharing, checks and balances. The system is designed to force the parties to compromise and find common ground. And it's not working now. And I think the country sees that, sees a federal government that can't solve problems and is deeply unhappy about it. What people want is some very substantial change, departures from the status quo, which is why we want radically pragmatic solutions. People aren't up for little tweaks in a status quo that they find intolerable. So everybody wants a bolder change now. And the trick here is to embrace a bold formula for change that can command majority support.
Marshall also talked about some of the major issues Democrats addressed in their election campaigns, aside from opposing most of Mr. Trump's policies.
Well, it's a midterm election, and midterm elections are local elections. They really aren't about a national party ideology or governing agenda because they're just a series of races across the map. Where the party, where Democrats will debate their philosophy will be after the midterm when we get into the next presidential cycle and the nomination battle. But I think the answer to your question, Carol, depends on where you are. This is a big, diverse country. And if you're in a deep blue place like New York or California or Massachusetts, well, you can't be critical enough of Donald Trump. But if you're out there in Ohio or Kansas or Iowa or even New Hampshire, more red to purple places, you've got to be careful because Democrats there can't just rely on Democratic votes. They have to win some independents and even some moderate Republicans. So they're not keying in on hatred of Donald Trump. They can't really afford to be successful in this more competitive terrain in American politics.
The following week, in the second installment, we featured Republican strategist Tim Chapman, executive director of Heritage Action for America, a conservative policy advocacy organization affiliated with the Heritage Foundation. That's a think tank based here in Washington. Analysts said at the time that Republicans had a cautiously optimistic approach to the election, but that their party would still be able to prevail. It turned out that the GOP lost control of the House of Representatives, but retained control of the Senate. Tim Chapman shared his thoughts on the approach and strategies Republicans used to fend off the enthusiasm and energy of the Democrats in the 2018 midterm elections.
You know, I think there's really two parallel universes going on right now in these midterm elections. The first universe is one where it's a war of attrition at the local level in district by district races. And that universe is one where you're talking about candidate X versus candidate Z and how they stand on the issues and what's specifically happening locally in that district. And then the second parallel universe is one that is a national conversation about the future of the country and a conversation about what we're seeing take place at the highest level and the highest, most dramatic stages of American politics. And I think what we are trying to do is we are trying to be a part of both of those. I think that we are clearly involved at the local race-by-race stage where we are going into specific districts and we are running the numbers and we are showing what is happening in these specific districts as a result of things like the deregulatory program this administration has put in place, as a result of the tax law that has been put in place. We're showing what the returns actually look like for an average family of middle-class family of four in the district, average single filers in the district. We're showing what's happening in terms of wages, job growth, that kind of thing. But then I think we also need to make sure that we are not ignoring the national conversation that's happening. And if you can, in a district, make the case that, hey, this is good for, you know, Andy Barr's district in Kentucky, and I think that case is very much there to be made, but then marry that with a conversation about what it is that the left actually wants if they are able to regain control of the House and potentially the Senate, and what might happen over the next 2 years if that were to happen, that more national conversation. That's what I think the strategy has to be. You can't ignore one or the other. You have to be involved in both.
And that's Press Conference USA's look back at 2018. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very happy and healthy new year. Thanks for listening today, and please join us again next week and next year for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.